Alright, so today is going to be part three of our three-part series on conversions. So just to remind ourselves, first two classes we spoke really about the situation here in America. And we talked about the challenges of the new centralized conversion system, the relationship between the American rabbinate and the Israeli chief rabbinate. And on the halachic side, we really centered our discussion around this issue of the acceptance of mitzvot. What I want to do now is to shift the conversation in two directions, or along two axes. Number one, geographically, and number two, halachically. Geographically, to move across the Atlantic and to consider the situation of Israel. And then halachically, we're going to stay on this question of Kabbalat Mitzvot, of accepting the commandments, with a focus, however, not on the adults, but for our purposes today, we're going to build on last week's discussion and 2 weeks ago's discussion about adults and think about the situation of children. In other words, the halachic question we need to examine is, let's assume we take for granted that in order for an adult to convert, that a full-fledged acceptance of mitzvot would be necessary, but perhaps there's another solution to the challenge in particular in Israel, the demographic challenge, that we would be able to address the Russian conversion crisis with the conversion of children, who arguably, although arguably not, perhaps there, the acceptance of mitzvot will be less essential, as we'll see.
Is so the Russian conversion crisis the same as the Ethiopian conversion crisis, or is there a difference?
There is a difference, if only because of the sheer numbers. That's one piece. There are two pieces. The first is that there were many...
It's a mass immigration.
That's right. Mass immigration. There are two differences. Number one, the numbers of Russians are still, I think, substantially higher, I believe. And number two, more to the point, there were many rabbis, including Rav Avadya Yosef, a great former Sephardic chief rabbi, who believed that the Ethiopians are Jewish.
Right.
So there wasn't a need for conversion. The challenge with the Russians is that we know with confidence that a substantial percentage are not Jewish. And we're very much easily able to identify just how high a percentage of population that is. Rav Avadya, basically, his psak about the Ethiopians became the standard Israeli policy. The government adopted it, and so on and so forth. Even though among other halachic decisors, it wasn't so simple. But once he and others signed on to that, it became generally accepted that the Ethiopians don't need to be converted en masse. You don't have to be concerned for all these issues.
One down.
They classify them under the chashash rule, which means that they were suspect. In other words, they were pretty sure, but they weren't quite 100% sure. So they went through a symbolic conversion, where I believe they drew a drop of blood,
right,
from the middle, from the
right, but it,
midsection,
right. No, that's correct, and that was what Ravadia required. But
right,
that was just, as you say, with Chumra, as an stringency. But it wouldn't have really been useful if we had not thought that there's going to be if it had been clear that there's no Kabbalat Mitzvot, it would have been useless. In other words, if there was a serious concern, we would have required the acceptance of Mitzvot. Most Ethiopians were not holding there, just like Russians were not holding there.
Right. What about the B'nai Menashe from Northeast India?
They're also similar to Rav Avadya. It was very interesting. Rav Avadya, some would say in part it's reflective of his identification with the Sephardic community in the sense that they're one, etc. But whatever the motivation might have been, or whatever might have been in the background, sociologically, etc., the bottom line is Rav Avadya integrated them, so that became very much the standard policy. It's a very different issue. The Russian Aliyah challenge is actually personal for me. We have family. My grandmother, who passed away about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago now. Actually, I have her picture for my wedding up there. So my grandmother originally was from Russia. She managed to get out, but her family, before the war, but her family, much of her family was stuck there. In 1959, they received some sort of visa or permission to leave, to get out from the Iron Curtain, which, as you know, was no small matter.
Yeah,
it was a very, very big deal. At the last moment, it was canceled. They were stuck in Russia until 1991.
Oh, yeah.
That was it. And get out. There are a few occasions when my grandmother and my father's older sister went to visit. And some really interesting stories from those visits. But other than that, you know, they snuck in a little kosher food and, you know, that kind of thing. Some of it was confiscated, some of it wasn't. The usual stuff, stories that you hear. But they weren't able to get out. And they had absolutely no Jewish education, no Jewish affiliation. All the stories that you hear, there's a reason. They're true stories, the factual. And they finally made it. They had the sense, though, that Israel was the place for them. So the entire remaining family made Aliyah. They live in Ma'alot, been that area near that is. It's about 5 kilometers south of the Lebanon border. So it's right up there. There's a very substantial Russian population that lives locally in that community. And it's a pretty popular destination for Russian Ogrim. Part of it is that, quite frankly, they didn't necessarily have so much financially back home. They weren't really trained in so many useful jobs that could be easily carried over. And so it was a cheaper area because, quite frankly, it wasn't a place that people wanted to settle because it was very close to the border. In fact, the government has a policy to actually give some chuparim, to give some help to families who want to resettle in Ma'alot because the incentives are not to live there. And it's not surprising that they need to offer that because a couple of summers ago, the Katyushas were raining down on Ma'alot. So it's a real thing. Now it's more built up, actually. It's interesting. There's a yeshivat hezder there. And there's a yeshiva that combines Torah learning and army service. There's one in Ma'alot. There are now over 40 of those yeshivat hezder across Israel. I mean, it's really remarkable. We definitely have some, there's nothing like Israel, but we definitely have some catching up to do in terms of higher education. These are all for people who graduate, gone through the Dati Lumi Israeli school system and are going on to their next steps. So many of them will study in Yeshivat Hester afterward, and they'll do both the learning, the army service, and go on to their university studies following, let's say, 5 years or something like that, all together combined. So Ma'alot has that now. But it's still, there's the Russian population is very disconnected. When we went, the first time we visited, when I was studying in Israel, my parents came for a trip, and we all went to see the family in Ma'alot for the first time. My father's first time speaking with them. And it was, in some ways, it was sad because, and they started lighting candles in Erev Shabbat, and some of the kids actually served in the Israeli army. But there was very little connection. You go and reunited, and you couldn't even have a conversation with them. Like, they didn't even know to ask about kashrut, even though they were living in Israel. Like, they had no idea. They were just going to serve us. They were serving us on regular things. They didn't even think to ask. And so it was a little bit sad. It was also remarkable, though, because my father actually grew up speaking Russian. That was his first language. Russian, Yiddish, and then English. When he was 7 and a half, they came to the States. But he actually grew up speaking Russian. He hasn't spoken any Russian for 40 years. I mean, he didn't speak a word. And once he came to America, there was no reason anymore. And they had terrible memories. The last thing they wanted to do was speak Russian. I mean, they want to distance themselves. So my father went to be reunited with the family. It was very interesting. Pretty much all of them, it was the first time he was meeting them. They started speaking Russian because that's what they know best. They didn't really know English. A little Hebrew, but they decided to start speaking Russian. And all of a sudden, it came back to him. Mm-hmm. It was right there. It was very, very striking. It was really remarkable. And he just, all of a sudden, this Russian of his childhood, that he hadn't spoken a word in literally 40 years, just like came back to him. It was really remarkable. You know, the languages that we learn when we're children, just they really stay with us. They're really embedded deep in our consciousness. So it's very personal when I think about the assimilation and the challenges in integrating the Russian Jewish population. It definitely speaks to me on a very personal level. And we know that the challenges are substantial. Let's say it's roughly 1 million, right, out of, you know, let's say it's nearly 12 million residents of Israel, something like that, Jewish and Arab combined.
I think it's eight million.
No, but then why do they think that
you're counting Gaza and
that's what it is. If you right, that's what I mean to say. If you would include them in the two states, right? If there were one solution, then it would be
west of the Jordan.
The demographic would be much closer. That's right. Good. So anyhow, so when we think about the population of Israel, think about say 1 million or so. Russian population, that's a huge amount of people. And many of them are not Jewish. And so the concern is that this is going to generate a marriage and Jewishness crisis in the Jewish community or in the Israeli population. So you have people who are serving in the army, they're fully integrated, they're going through all the institutions, but they're not Jewish, and they're friendly with, and they're serving with, and they're in class with, and they're going to be marrying the people that they study with in university. Right? That's a given. And so it's extremely challenging because then you have Jews and non-Jews who are marrying, and then you have the next
and
generation, next generation.
Don't get married by the Israeli rabbinate anyway.
As a separate challenge also. Right. In other words, you're saying among this population. Oh yeah, they're specifically going elsewhere. Absolutely, no question about that. Although now there are a handful of rogue rabbis in Israel who are doing this. Technically, you can actually be arrested for doing this. But there are many rabbis who believe that it's a real struggle. I mean, the religious Zionist community, generally, unfortunately, the reputation of the chief rabbinate is not what one might aspire toward. Let's say that. And certainly in terms of their ability to work skillfully with people who are not integrated religiously, who are not observant, who don't really have any connection to Yiddishkeit in a meaningful way. One of the great challenges of the chief rabbinate is that many of those families feel like they're facing, they're encountering a faceless bureaucracy, and not human beings who understand their needs, who want to work with them as people to create a positive, warm relationship. And in America, you want to get married, so you have maybe an old teacher, you have somebody that your family has a relationship with, you study, you learn, you prepare, and hopefully work together to build a really meaningful and beautiful ceremony. In Israel, it looks and feels very different. So there are two major camps. So there are those who believe that we should collaborate with the rabbinate to build the best thing that we can, and that's in all these areas, and this is certainly included. And there are others who believe that at least in certain domains, we have no choice. We would love to see a world in which things look different, but given the realities on the ground, we need to build alternatives. And so those are the two streams. The major religious Zionist organization of rabbis and religious leadership in Israel, Sohar, Bridge, which is about building bridges between observant and non-observant, between Dati and Chiloni Israelis, they actually recently started their own kashrut agency, or they're just now launching it. There's been a lot of talk around this, an internal dispute, because they believe that ultimately they have no choice but to build something else that will be competitive toward the rabbinate for the sake of the good of the nation, bring prices down, economic competition, and also to basically apply pressure to improve the standards, improve transparency, putting better systems in place and all that. So what we're going to see now is exactly those two schools of thought in terms of how to respond to the
chief rabbinate. Is there concern over the fact that there's the conservative and the reform have also established their own smaller groups of rabbinate in Israel now? That and they're involved in their own conversions and marriages, that those that are not accepted by the Orthodox are moving towards them, and that with their immersions into the society, into the broader spectrum, also with their marriages into general populations, and then you've got the Russians and every other group merging towards a reform and the conservative, as you do here in this country, then you've got presence, and the Orthodox movement, Ultra-Orthodox, they're not accepting them as well.
Right.
Then you have this, now you have a whole new body of conversions going on in Israel, and the acceptance of those conversions.
Right.
And as this becomes more pluralistic in Israel, what the consequences of these conversions and the acceptance of these children within Israel and the population as it.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's a fantastic question. I'm not on the ground. I don't know for sure. My sense is that the Israeli community does not perceive the non-Orthodox movements to have sufficient following and traction in Israel to be posing a significant challenge to the future. Obviously, it's highly publicized here, Women in the Wall, and these kinds of challenges. But whenever I hear Israelis talk about it, they just don't see, and maybe part of it is the history, and maybe the future will look different than the past has. Not only time will tell, but my sense is they think that it's just culturally so distant that most Israelis think of Orthodoxy as authentic religion. They don't necessarily all want to live their lives every single day like that, but in Yom Kippur, when they go to shul, they want to go to a traditional Orthodox shul. And the like. They would have a traditional Seder and so on and so forth. So that doesn't seem to be their major concern, whether it will remain that way or there will be more traction. And only time will tell. But that's my sense of that.
And the numbers are really small.
Yeah,
look at the actual numbers.
I mean, we have a friend who is a reform rabbi in Israel, and they have 600 members, 600 families at their shul. Right. So I see his postings and the conversions that go on in their show. So it's small compared to because they're a new Shalayim. So, but I just hear what goes on. But looking at the conversation of how will that affect in the long run?
Right.
And that's only one shul, and Israel's a very.
Right.
But as things come down the line, how will that affect in the future?
We'll see, and I think you're right. I think it's going to depend mostly on numbers. If those communities are able to gain more traction in Israel. whether with an Anglo population or otherwise, then I think that that would be a real game changer. If in Tel Aviv and places like that, this is something that became attractive for Israelis. You know, I think most Israeli rabbis feel like it's not something that's culturally organic for Israelis. It came from other communities,
Aline,
specifically.
A lot of Olim breaking.
That's the question. Right. No, no, but I'm saying in terms of, 100%.
Right, because it started as an Olim shul. Yeah. It started with the Americans and the
right.
French.
Right.
And then now with the Russians. But now the congregation is more turning towards Israelis. And the next generations are all Israeli born. And then
right.
We'll
see what happens.
But now, you never know what's going to happen.
Also, right. the reform movement in Israel is much more traditional than
yeah,
it is here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's not.
So you really can't compare. It's not like apples to apples. It's very traditional
mm-hmm.
in comparison.
Right. Good. Excellent. Thanks. All right. So the challenge is clear. The challenge in terms of the Russian Aliyah per se is this question of non-Jewish children who believe that they're Jewish. Also, the challenge of what we call mamzirut, in other words, children who are halachically not necessarily able to marry other Jews because of the circumstances in which their parents were married. And these are very serious and weighty halachic challenges. About 2 years ago, or a year and a half, I guess, there were a number of prominent religious Zionist rabbis who decided to take the bull by the horns. They felt like this was such a big crisis and has been essentially simmering for a few decades already. And we just need to stand up and do something different. And in particular, David Stav. And I gave you a quick piece of a write-up from the New York Times on August 11, 2015. Is anyone familiar with the name of David Stav? Is that a familiar name? In the previous cycle, he was one of the final three candidates to be Ashkenazic chief rabbi.
Right.
And this would have been a major moment for the religious Zionist community, because the chief rabbinate, although it was initially founded by Rav Kook and was a religious Zionist institution, for a whole host of reasons now is largely or much more in the control of a Haredi population. And there is a real sense that the next generation of Israelis to be connected, to feel any sense of a bridge between the institution of the rabbinate and the wider Israeli public, that if we had someone who looked, spoke more modern, and also understood what the experience of everyday Israelis or Chiloni would be, that would allow for greater integration and more effectiveness in terms of the Israeli chief rabbinate really representing and serving the wider Israeli community. So that was Rav Stav. That is Rav Stav. Rav Stav is also very involved in this organization, Zohar. And I think around the time he became a candidate for chief rabbi, and then it didn't work out. He kind of saw how sometimes in politics and these kinds of things, I'm not sure this would happen, but this is my own reconstruction. This is certainly from afar what it looked like. He kind of perhaps learned the lesson, or perhaps came to the opinion that it's not always going to work to follow the system. That there are moments when you see that the system is really broken. You try to fix it from within. You do everything that you can. But ultimately, if the future of the Jewish people is contingent upon this challenge, then it might be necessary to create a new avenue, a new approach. So Rav Stav, together with Rabbi Riskin and a number of others, established, and first Reh Talmidei Chachamim, established an alternative conversion Beit Din. Okay, remember, the Israeli army has basically been converting a small number of Russians for quite some time, and there are already attempts to do this. There's a Rav Drukman, who's on the Beit Din, who's the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Or Etzion, which is an Israeli Hesder Yeshiva. He was very involved in these kinds of, in a conversion court that was similar in nature in a prior Gilgul, in a prior version, and Rav Drukman took a lot of heat. There was a rabbi of one of the Batei Din who not only disqualified his conversions, he disqualified Rav Drukman entirely. He said that these conversions, anyone who would perform conversions like this of minors who have not fully accepted the mitzvot, will essentially, not only are his conversions puzzled, disqualified, but he himself could not possibly be of the halachic standing to perform such a conversion. He called him a kofar, the whole nine yards. This is from an Haredi rabbi, a very leading rabbi. His name is Rabbi Sherman, very much to the right and very outspoken. And then the religious Zionist rabbis rallied to Rabbi Drukman's defense, but this was the back and forth. So Rabbi Drukman had tried to do this. He's involved in this space. And Rav Stav, I give it to you here, read a little bit of that. Rav Stav, who was mono-Orthodox and 2 years ago ran unsuccessfully through one of Israel's two chief rabbis, said the new conversion court was a necessity after the government's reversal on the conversion bill. So in other words, there's a minister, Elazar, you might be familiar with his name, who's tried to work, Elazar Stern, right? Who tried to push through this legislation. Initially, the government was for it. What happens is, with the way that the coalition politics work, basically, Bibi usually creates coalitions with the Haredi partners. There are certain promises that are made in order that he not lose his government. The Bibi basically capitulates to the Haredim. That's typically how it's gone, and that's why Yesh Atid has a very different agenda and a different approach. But that's basically it. So very often what happens is there'll be Knesset discussion, there'll be deliberation, and then in the end of the day, because of the coalition politics, ultimately whatever promises were made in the initial committee conversations will not come to fruition. Welcome to Israeli politics. This is like Masam Shebechol Yom. Exactly. If you don't understand the basics of the coalition politics in Israel, you just, I mean, you might be frustrated anyway. But it's probably frustrated anyway. But you can't begin to understand how to handle things in government. It's just, it's the key to everything.
Yeah, but now that's we don't know if our own two-party system works anymore either.
What? I'm not, well, I'm not suggesting, what? I'm not suggesting which one is better or worse. I'm just, you know, that's what Churchill said, right? Democracy is merely the least poor form of government that we've identified at this point.
Well, right? The others are so much worse.
Right? That's it. Look at the history of humanity. I understand why, with all of our warts and all, why we do what we do.
Can I give you an example during this period of time of a conversion?
Sure, I'd love to. Let me just finish this for anyone who not yet get a chance to read it. He said 4,500 children are born each year to Israeli families whose Judaism is not recognized. Boys and girls are going to the university. They're going to the army. If they are not converted, there will be an assimilation crisis in Israel. Rabbi Stav, who attended the conversion ceremony on Monday, said the children's parents, this is the government one, I believe, have been required to sign papers to prove they understood that the right would not be recognized by the government or by the chief rabbinate. In other words, this is unofficial. He's going around, and there's no guarantee. They're trying to apply pressure to the rabbinate, but there's no guarantee that when there's a few next generation, two generations down, that it's going to be accepted by the chief rabbinate. And
so
they say that straight up.
So nobody accepts.
Many religious Zionist rabbis would accept it. So okay. It depends on who you go, and depending on the town, it's very complicated.
One more section.
You have the same things. He says, oh, but just listen to what he says. He says, it is recognized by God, he noted. So the rabbinate may not accept it, but it's recognized by God. Eventually, there'll be no other way but to recognize them. Okay?
So he says.
I mean, he's all he can do is represent his own opinion. He can't do any more than that. Eventually, there'll be no other way to recognize them. There'll be no other way but to recognize them officially. In other words, the hope is apply the pressure to the chief rabbinate and they'll buckle. It's worked in certain ways. We'll see what happens. But that was the attempt.
So about this time, we actually have a family member. Well, my husband has a family member who, the father is a Holocaust survivor, got married very late in life, and has a child who's my husband's my age, a little younger than I am, and on his mother's deathbed found out that she didn't finish the conversion. So he, his entire life, he grew up as an Orthodox Jew. His whole life did not realize that he wasn't Jewish. So he'd been living in Israel, and was planning, he had met a woman and found out he technically was not Jewish. Right. So he went to his rabbi in Israel, and the rabbi explained to him around this period of time that he, it's actually a little bit younger than I am, explained that he should not do a conversion in Israel because the politics in Israel is so complicated. Mm-hmm. This conversion could take years to do.
All right.
And the politics is so complicated. Mm-hmm. That they recommended he leave Israel and have a conversion in another country. So that way he would be recognized and then come back to Israel, but not to convert.
Wow.
And so, but the rabbi said to him, if you don't want to take my opinion, I'm going to give you three other rabbis to go talk to. And so he went and spoke to all three of these rabbis in three different cities, and they all gave him the exact, all Orthodox rabbis gave him the exact same opinions, leave Israel, do not convert here.
Right.
And he was about to do his master's degree, and they all, and he got accepted to master's in Israel, all these programs, and they all said to him, leave, do not convert here. And he ended up going to London, and he's now doing his conversion in London. And they all said to him, and there were places they all agreed that London was the best place, that Israel would recognize London's conversion, and they said to him, don't go to the U.S. It would not be recognized in Israel if you come to the U.S. There's too much politics in Israel in the U.S.
Yeah.
to be recognized in Israel. But
we're
don't stay in Israel.
Between the U.S. and the chief rabbi,
right.
in other words.
But they said, go to England.
Right.
And so they're now doing it in England, and he happens to have met a woman, and so then they have to, whatever, but... So they're finishing up the conversion, and they started and finished it in England, and that's where they're doing it. And all four rabbis have agreed that London would be accepted with no question in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So he's doing it in England. It's almost done, but they all agree that not.
Because what happened is the London based in is more traditional.
Right.
That's when Rabbi Sacks was chief rabbi. He was constantly caught between the London Basin and the larger English Jewish communities. Impossible position to be in. Right? That's why he says, you know,
right.
Baruch Hashem when I finish after 22 years, right? Because they're very difficult questions, and it's impossible
but
spot to be
in.
It
was very interesting that they told him not to convert in Israel. So
Rabbi Sacks obviously was a very skillful
diplomat.
And I'm wondering how long that'll last, because now
he's out.
He has a follower, so that has to step in his shoes.
Anyway, we'll see with Rabbi Sacks. But I think in London, in other words, the point is the debate, there has not been another group that said, oh, we're going to go do a different set of conversions. In other words, in Israel, that's exactly the split that's developed. In America, also, that's part of the split that's developed, right? That there are the rabbis who want to do through the more traditional framework of the Rabbinical Council of America, and there are rabbis who say, we don't agree with that, and we never agreed with that, we're doing it differently. And the chief rabbinate reads that, and they don't really know the scene, so they just want to say... you know, no, as a more of a default matter, or at least sometimes there's a temptation for that. In London, it hasn't been that split. I think that's the difference.
But well, it's very sad. Interesting that they would say, like in Israel, there's four rabbis who've all said, don't convert in Israel. Go elsewhere.
And you know, and now you understand, it's very depressing.
Well, like,
and it's
recommended by one, though, so...
You know. But they were on three different cities, though. Like, even though they recommended
one,
you know, you're sending some too. But even it's not for completely independent pins. But and there's a reason that people are setting up separate batidim. You don't just, these are very responsible, system-oriented people. It's not people who are iconoclasts who are looking to break down the whole system and start all over again. They just want to do the best thing for the Jewish people, and they just feel like they have no recourse. That's really the issue.
I just wanted to say, I don't know if later they may have said it, but. That the tension is caused by the disparity between the law of return and halachic standards for Judaism, because
yes.
the law of return
yeah,
wants to
mm-hmm.
bring people in who are persecuted and
right.
the very loose
connections right.
to you know, you can have a Jewish grandparent
right.
or something like that.
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
you can be not halachically Jewish and have a right to live in
yeah.
Israel, and that's what they wanted to encourage, so that exacerbates this.
Absolutely, and maybe further, if we didn't have that, if that law were not in place, then we might not have
it. It's a good thing that law was in place, though.
Yeah, absolutely, it's a reason. It was a post-Holocaust law, it's exactly that's
but,
where
I mean,
they
I
came from.
That's something that's
right?
That's
what they called it. They called it, it was Hitler's calculus,
yeah.
right? That was basically...
Turned on its head.
Right.
And it's integral to Israel, so these problems are
absolutely.
Continuing.
Well
that's
said.
Why I need to be resolved.
Very well said. Yep, very well said. Absolutely, 100%. When Rav Stam starts this beit din, there are a number of rabbis who push back. If in Israel there are a couple of streams of within religious Zionism, and the Merkaz Harav community, which is the yeshiva founded by Rav Kook, tend to be more religiously conservative, lowercase c, on many matters, and so that group essentially pushed back and was opposed to this. So, for example, you take a look at source 2, we're not going to read it, but basically, we're opposed to this, we're opposed in particular to the way that they're handling the conversion of minors, which we'll come to. I mean, you have a whole list of rabbis who are associated with that, starting on page 2 at the top, Rav Lior is there. He's a prominent name that you might have heard of as chief rabbi of Hebron. As you can see, Rav Tau. Rav Tau was one of the great students of Rav Kook's son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook. And Rav Tau is the head of Har Hamor, which is a very influential, deeply conservative institution, which is very much associated with what's called the Chardal movement in Israel. Uh-huh. Is that familiar?
Chardal.
Yeah, as opposed to mustard seeds. Chardal is... right. Just saying. There's just some dispute as to whether that's a meaningful association or just coincidental. But Haredi Lumi, these are basically... It's more... The religious ethos is anti-modern. Right, there's deep discomfort and opposition, strong opposition to modernity writ large, to the study of modernity or modern literature and so on and so forth. At the same time, it's a Zionist community. And that's it, right? The Haredi Lumi, very often associated with the settlement movement, not exactly the same thing, but there's plenty of overlap there. So that's that. So many of these rabbis are associated with that world, with that movement. Okay. The most interesting thing I've seen about this, and I'm no statistician and I haven't studied anything, is from an old friend of mine named Eli Fisher. Eli Fisher is a thoughtful guy who lives in Modi'in, and he's often enjoys being well outside the box. He also feels that the chief rabbin is completely mishandling lots of things, and he believes that only through equal competition can Israeli society be advanced. So he believes that we should create kashrut, marriage, conversion, what have you, alternatives to the chief rabbi, create an open marketplace, essentially force the political factions to accept the reality on the ground of competition, and in that way break the monopoly of the chief rabbi. He's not shy for having said so. If you go on and just look on his Facebook posts, you'll see that he runs the risk of being in prison. That's not something that's not in the public domain, but he doesn't think that it'll act on it. And there was actually an interview they did. They actually interviewed him in Israeli television about this. Mm-hmm. Him, maybe one of the other ones who was involved in this. So he's quite bold. In other words, all these couples who are going to Cyprus to get married, there are a handful of rabbis who are marrying them in Israel outside of the framework of the chief rabbinate. That's illegal.
So are those marriages recognized?
It's an act of disobedience.
Are they married? Who recognizes those marriages?
This is the same challenge. If you go to
like
an official,
when you have conservative reform conversions not accepted by Orthodox, and then what does that accomplish? Okay, a divided community.
Right. So it depends. They believe that ultimately, in the short term, it creates a divided community, but in the long term, it's going to actually be the best thing for converts and for marriages, etc. In other words, that the current system, as well intentioned as it is if we're driving people to go to Cyprus to get married, right? They're leaving the Jewish state for marriage. We must not be doing something right. So although it's true that short term comes with a certain cost, right? The goal is essentially to transform the face of the religious public face of religion in Israel. That's no small recipe. That's a big deal. His argument in here, and I'm not going to go through all the math of it, but if you're a statistics person, this is something to dig into and to research further. His claim is that the entire crisis is overstated and will resolve itself in a matter of generations. Here's his argument. He says, if you actually look, his first thing is he says, the way that we talk about this is everyone takes for granted there's this great crisis, and then the only question is how to resolve it. So he says, did anyone stop and actually ask whether or not we have a demographic crisis on our hands? It matters whether this is something that affects a handful of people or is going to dramatically change the face of the Jewish state in the generations to come. So he says, dig the chart, got a little bit messed up, but basically, if you see it on page 3, the first is based on the 2003 official Israeli census, and essentially what they found, or a census of the population of Israel, and what they found is the numbers are, these are Jews and others, and then you have the, basically, among the non-Arab population, right? In other words, this is the difference between, excluding the Arab population, between a Jewish and non-Jewish percentage of people. And if you take a look, essentially the bottom line is that the percentage of Russian Olim and other non-Jews who are living in Israel, who are part of the larger Israeli population, has been significantly declining over the course of the last number of years. Okay, and not only that, but if you take a look, the key finding here is what's actually shown in this chart is that there's a major discrepancy between adults and children. In other words, the younger you get, the more likely people are to be Jewish, which would imply that we're actually accomplishing something.
How's that possible?
What's going on?
I don't get it mathematically.
So, well, what it means is that the children of the next generation are more likely Jewish, as you project this trend forward.
But how is that happening?
His suggestion is as follows. If you can look at the continuation, he says that there are currently about 1,800 Russian Olim who are converted annually in Israel.
How many?
1,800. It's a relatively small number, he says. Mm-hmm. But he says, here, you can read it together, the bottom paragraph on page 3. The most important reason, however, is conversion itself. According to the IDI abstract, that's the Democratic Institute that took these numbers, about 1,800 immigrants from the FSSU convert annually in Israel. It's not a lot. The important question is not how many convert, rather, who are the converts? Various organizations raise the alarm by relating only to the first question regarding the second, more important question. Who then are the converts? The overwhelming majority of them are women between the ages of 18 and 30. As is well known, according to Halakha, the mother determines the status of the child. The Jew is someone born to a Jewish mother. Mm-hmm. So he says like this. Stands to reason that this is published in a major publication in Israel online. It stands to reason that a similar scenario plays out in many Jewish homes in Israel. When a daughter comes home with her boyfriend, who turns out to be a non-Jew, perhaps the family is not pleased and they may even encourage him to convert. They may even become frustrated when some rabbi insists that the groom must accept Orthodox observance in order to convert, even if he already identifies as a Jew, speaks Hebrew, serving the IDF, etc. Ultimately, though, the family knows that the grandchildren will be Jewish. Therefore, if the couple must fly to Cyprus, their Czech Republic, in order to wed civilly, if they opt for common law marriage, it's not so terrible. The grandchildren will be Jewish. But if it's a son, it's the opposite, right? Mm-hmm. If someone comes up with a non-Jewish woman, suddenly there's a concern the grandchildren will not be Jewish, the parents will be animate that the woman convert. They want Jewish grandchildren, of course. Moreover, once the conversion process begins, they discover that the rabbis in the conversion court may also want to discover how Jewish children. Many obstacles faced by the potential converts will not be faced by women of childbearing age because the next generation is not of paramount
importance.
What?
It's a double standard.
But he's saying it's the Israelis who are doing this in their homes. Right. It's not anyone who's coming up with this rule.
No, but I mean they're making it easier for the Jewish women, the women of childbearing.
Well, he's saying that those are the ones that they want to. Yeah. Right. Yeah. This happened in the situation which the number of non-Jewish, non-Arab brothers in Israel slowly shrinks. In essence, is a natural process of assimilation. The country with the Jewish majority, the others assimilate to the Jewish population, not the other way around. It turns out this is a great line, whether you agree or not. It turns out that fear of assimilation is a habit inherited from the diaspora.
Oh, that's true.
The remnant of a mentality that we have developed as a minority. Today in the state of Israel, there is nothing to fear.
Reassuring.
Right? Well, in a way, it is reassuring. It seems that the natural, as he's saying, is once you have a Jewish population, it's sort of a self-correcting process. Actually, quite powerful, right? It seems that the natural response of an Israeli family seems a great deal of wisdom. There's no need for experiments in social engineering to treat a non-existent problem. As Jewish sages said, leave the Jews alone if they are not prophets. They are the children of prophets. So, look, I haven't done this. This is all I have.
So wait,
all I have. Like, not everyone agrees with him. I don't know. I don't know what the issues are. I haven't seen. I just don't know. That's his claim.
That's such an interesting idea. That's like a diaspora issue. That they've been rooted.
Isn't that a brilliant? Yeah.
It's, and of course, all the friends that we know who worry about it are Olim who came from the diaspora. You know.
Right. The Israelis are, but. All of Israel, or almost all of Israel, in one way or another, right, is ultimately from the diaspora. We all, right? There's next to no one living there.
Right.
So, you know, even if it's a few generations back, you know, even the most born and bred Sabras have in their family and in their blood some sort of memory of that. That's a look, it's a humorous line, and I'm not sure if there aren't people in Israel who would or did take offense to that line, because it seems bright but gratuitous also. I don't know. So I'm not sure. I don't know the answer, but if anyone wants to do more research, I'd love to hear what you find. Be that as it may, I want to spend a few minutes just looking at the halachic questions that are relevant, assuming that there really is a crisis, and assuming that the best route to deal with this issue is not just, right, I should just say, the conversions that Chaim Drukman was doing, those were adult conversions, generally, of someone through Tzahal and the like. I mean, that was the kind of process that we're talking about. If you take a look at what's happening now in this space in the containers, so that's just halachically different. Because we dealt with the issues of the adults in the last classes, that's why I want to turn to the issues of the children. So first of all, just on the halachic side, the notion of converting a child is an interesting one. It is not self-evident as a matter of halacha. Why would that be? Because if it's true that conversion requires a declaration of will on the part of a mature individual, then a child, halachically speaking, a boy under 13, a girl under 12, is not invested with what halacha denotes as dat, as halachic intentionality, halachic intelligence. Doesn't mean our kids are dumb or stupid or anything like that, but it does mean that they lack a certain kind of halachic standing and gravitas because of their relative immaturity. So who says that you can convert as a child? At the same time, the notion of a family converting and then the child not converting, and then the complexities that could come with that seem quite substantial. And on the one hand, you necessarily want to decide for every kid. At the same time, imagine what that means. A parent with an infant is going to convert to Judaism, and then when the kid is 12 or 13 or something like that, you're going to have to start all over with them. That seems hard to imagine, too. So how do we handle this? So the Gemara takes for granted, and history has shown that, to the best of my knowledge, this has gone together with adult conversion. And the Gemara actually says in Ketubot quite explicitly that Amarav Huna Ger Katan Matbilin Otel Dad Beitim, source 4, that a minor, we actually convert this child on the basis of the knowledge or intention of the court. So in other words, there's some sort of implicit consent that the court, that the Beitim, it receives on the part of the family, and that is sufficient to convert this child. So the Gemara says this is obvious. My kamash malan, says the Gemara. What does this come to teach us? Dizechut hulo? Asked the Gemara, that this is a merit for the child, v'zachim adam shelo b'fanav, and that we merit for a person even when that individual is not present. Rashi explains that because of the katan, because the minor lacks halachic knowledge, it's as if the child is not before us. It's ki'ilu ino b'faneinu, as if the child is not present. So we're doing it in lieu of, in standing of the katan, essentially. So what are you telling me? That we can achieve a merit on someone's behalf, even with that person not being present, for the sake of the child? After all, we know that. Tanina, we already taught that zachan adam shelo b'fanav, that we merit on someone's behalf even when they're not here. So for example, if I know there's $1,000 lying here and I merit, I pick up the $1,000 on behalf of another individual that I know, presumably most people would want to take a free gift of $1,000. So that works. It's a zechut. It's a merit. If it's a promissory note, right? If it's a bill, then it's not going to work. I can't just acquire that on someone's behalf. So the Gemara says, we already know that you can merit for someone when they're not present. We don't achieve a demerit for an individual not in front of that person. So Gemara answers that no. As in other words, the Gemara's question is, it's obvious that we can convert a child. A child, this is a zechut, to become a Jewish person. It's considered to be a merit, the Gemara assumes implicitly, takes for granted. And therefore, since this is a merit, we should be able to convert this child. So the Gemara says, well, mahu detima, what might I have thought? That ove kochavim, that the Gentile prefers a life that is unbounded. Right? The 613 commitments are perhaps a great privilege, but are also, right, can at times be burdensome, can be difficult for us. So therefore, perhaps the Gentile prefers just the free life of just the 7 Noahide commandments, and that's enough for me. So the Gemara says, when it comes to a servant, that certainly even a life of even promiscuity is something that servants, slaves at the time of the Gemara apparently was typical for their lifestyle. So the Gemara says, no, there's a difference between an adult and a child. When it comes to an adult, the Gemara says that Kamash once comes to teach us the Hani Mili Gadol, this is only true of an adult, the Ta'am Ta'am Yisura, who went out and understands really to what it means to live a free and fun life, as it were, unbounded by the commandments. Aval Katan, that's already different. Aval Katan Zechut Hula. When it comes to a child, to a minor, so it's considered to be a merit. Okay, so I'm going to stop here in the Gemara. Just one addition from the continuation of the Gemara. The Gemara does go on to say also that a child, interestingly enough, who converted has the right to opt out. This is a very interesting halakha. At 12 or 13, they can actually say, this is not for me. So this is a very interesting kind of thing. However, we said before that conversion is permanent. That's it. This is the one exception. If it's a child who converts, you can opt out. In practice, what this means is we do not go to the child and say, when it's bar bar mitzvah, do you want to stay in or out, right? That could end badly. But what it does mean is if the child at such a young age, and that's highly unusual, but if a child at such a young age has clearly adopted a very different lifestyle, or maybe is now living with a different family who's not right, in those kinds of situations it might be pertinent, but in everyday life usually it doesn't come up. It It's not a common thing to happen.
The young girl is betrothed, it's the same thing. She could opt out when she turns 12, right?
No, that's only in a case... it's in a case where the father died, but the mother or brother marries. That's called Mion. It's a more limited case, but there is a parallel there to the concept, rough parallel to the concept of Mion.
So if a child has a breast as an infant, is that so then the conversion is done?
If that was the intention of the family. Now we're going to have to figure out what the parameters for the conversion are.
So if it's a Jewish father, the mother's working on a conversion once the breast
mikvah, mikvah also.
I mean, sorry, the mikvah and the breast, and then so the child's considered Jewish, mm-hmm. and is raised as a Jewish child, and there's right. nothing, well, until the bar mitzvah, but like, right. so then the child then comes into Jewish schools, and...
Whole 9 years.
And yep. then so the little girl is just the mikvah, and then everything is done.
Same thing. Right? Yeah. Same process. Yep. So that's what the Gemara says. A very interesting concept.
So a child born of a non-Jewish mother can be converted at birth?
Yeah. That's exactly what we're talking about. Now, we're going to have to figure out what are the parameters in practice. So that's mm-hmm. what we're going to have to... That's what's that same thing. But in principle, that's what can happen. And that does happen. If you take a look at Rashi, there's some debate as to... Because this kind of conversion without the intention of the child is halachically, as we said, not intuitive, not obvious, because the child lacks the intention to make that decision. And in fact, there is one view among the commentaries that this form of conversion is only rabbinic in nature. Because after all, the child can't consent. And that might explain how the child can opt out. Because whoever heard of a conversion invested with biblical standing, that then 10 years later, you can just say, you know what, thanks for no thanks, I'm out of here. Must be some commentators say it's only rabbinic. So that's one view, is that this
Wait,
is not full-fledged conversion. What that means is that it's actually a good question. It's quite difficult. Mm-hmm. It's a category. It's a good thing we don't paskin that way, because it's hard to understand. But it would be that we'd have to kind of, in certain ways, treat them like Jews, and other ways like Gentiles. It's quite,
really?
Yeah, it's quite unusual. Yeah, and then I think that's part of the reason that we don't necessarily follow that position, but... It is quite complex. And that's manifest in Rashi. Rashi, for example, says that Rashi seems to disagree with that. Rashi's been told as one of those who maintains that it's biblical in character. Because Rashi says, for example, we know that there's a law that if a Gentile touches the wine, that can prohibit it to a Jew. Right? If this conversion were only rabbinic in nature, so then presumably perhaps this biblical Gentile would still contaminate the wine. So Rashi says, no, it's a full-fledged conversion, he says. Mm-hmm. Says, so Shlosha, bottom page 6, Shloshi v'tvilato, there must be 3 judges present at his immersion, Gidin kol tvilat ger, shetzrichim gimel, just as we always require 3 judges present at the adult conversion, same applies to the child conversion. So he says, Behein na'asin lo av, it says, if the parent, the beitin, themselves represent the parents, they stand in for the child, or for the parents of the child, rather, Vare hu ger al yedehen, and he becomes a convert through them, umaga'o bayayin kasher, his contact with the wine does not contaminate it. So this is brought by many commentaries as evidence that Rashi, and this is what we generally accept, that this is a full-fledged biblical conversion, just like the adult form.
Wait, so can I ask a question? So, say the mother's going through a conversion but hasn't finished it when the child's born. So you have a breast for the baby and then the mikvah. And then the mother decides, I'm not going to finish the conversion, but the father's wants to raise the child Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
The child's still Jewish.
It's already happened?
Because they already had the breast. They had the...
Once it happened again, there's this...
But it doesn't matter what the mother decides to do now because the father's...
Once it's done, it's done. If I convert and... 5 years later, 5 days later, really, I changed my mind. If I was genuinely fully committed at the time, the conversion is complete. With the exception of this situation of the child opting out at 12, 13, other than that, it's a done deal. We don't turn back.
So are the parents obligated to inform this 12 or 13-year-old of the opt-out?
They are. We generally say they're not.
What?
No.
So it's like a don't ask, don't tell situation?
Something exactly like that. Wink, wink. Okay.
Statistically, then you don't need the mother to convert them because you can always have... The father, then you can take a child to a Beit Din, and you can always do a conversion for the child without the mother being
in principle, but the question is going to be what are the parameters of this category? Because the question is, we're going to see twofold. Number one, where's the Kabbalah mitzvot in this case? The acceptance of mitzvot. Right, that's what we're going to have to talk about. And number two, what happens if the family is not observant? Mm-hmm. So you're talking about a situation where the parents are intermarried.
Yeah.
And yet they say that we want to raise an observant child. That's complicated.
Well,
right?
Or if the
Is a Beit Din going to, you know, what are the parameters here?
That's right. You're still right? That issue.
That's quite complex. This becomes...
Wait, who does an infant conversion? It's not the mo'el.
You need the rabbi, you need the Beit Din, etc.
But you need a rabbi and Beit Din to paskin on it.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
But didn't it say here that the Beit Din has to be standing in for the parents, so
right.
There has to be some kind of understanding of what the parents are agreeing to. There has to be some correlation.
That's where we're going. Yes, it's exactly where we're going with 100%. Okay. So what are we going to do with this? By the way, we're not going to go through right now, but Tosfot in Sanhedrin, source 6, also seems to hold that it's biblical. And again, that's a generally accepted halacha. Now, the question came up in the 19th century, in modern period in particular, this problem of the not fully committed parents who want to convert their children, because you can see immediately why that's of direct relevance, not only to the question that was just raised, but also to the Israeli situation. Mm-hmm. With the Russian Aldin, clearly the parents have no intention of becoming fully halachic in any meaningful way. They want to be traditionally associated with the Jewish community significantly as well, but not going to become observant.
The child observant. So why should converts have to be more observant than their born in?
Well, no, but that goes to last. It's a fair question, but it's a complicated question, because if we do believe that it's the commitment to mitzvot and the experience of Mount Sinai that bound together was the formative moment for the Jewish people, that's unfortunately, sadly, not the entire Jewish population is fully committed to the observance of those mitzvot. So without assigning blame, but that's something that we can say is not the ideal situation. But if that's the sine qua non of what it means to be a Jew, then it may well be, as we were saying, sine qua non of what it means to become a Jew. And you could imagine a scenario in which the criteria for becoming a Jew are different than the criteria to be a Jew. And you can think of examples of that in all sorts of analogous cases as well. But the 19th century, really, after the rise of modernity and after the impact of Haskalah and so on and so forth, so now all of a sudden you have this notion of Jewish denominations, whether formal denomination, talking about earlier in terms of Reform, Conservative, etc., or just not observant subcultures within the Jewish community, where that's a real option for people. And there was a number of responses that dealt with this question and grappled with it on two levels. On one level, again, what constitutes acceptance of mitzvot? If the child cannot accept mitzvot, then maybe the parents have to somehow accept for the child. And then maybe it has to be realistic to assume that the child will then eventually graduate, as it were, into a life of Torah and mitzvot. And then, of course, the question becomes again, just like we said with the what does it mean to live a life that's committed to Torah and mitzvah? It would seem that the Russian population does not rise to that level. No one would claim that they do. That's not the general plan. There are exceptions, but that's not the general rule. That's one. The second question is very interesting and challenging. What does it mean to be a merit? Because remember, the Gemara said the basis for the conversion of the minor is this halachic category that we perform merits for someone who's not physically before us. And the child is as if he or she is not before us. So here's the question. Is it, and this is a very charged one, but this is exactly the crux of the issue. Is it a merit or a demerit for someone to convert to become a Jew, but live essentially a life of non-halachic observance? Which is more of a zechut, to be a Gentile or to be a Jew whose family violates Shabbat and so on and so forth, Kashrut, etc.? Is that a zechut?
Well, it's a zechut in the sense that there's always the potential for that person to become more accepting of mitzvot.
Good.
But if you're the Jew, you're sinning, and if you're the goy, you're
right.
Just do the seven mitzvot that they know of, and you're happy. Yeah.
Right. It's complicated being Jewish. It's not the woman's like, this chosen people, like, why did it, like, what? You're going to come pay yeshiva tuition. I'll show you chosen people. It's not so simple. But this is the question. And this is a really complex, just think about it for a moment. This is a theological question, right? What's the weight of being a Jew versus being a Gentile? It's a question of the standing of what it means to be a Jew who is doing one's best, but has not been initiated into a life of Torah and Sotan. How do we weigh that? these are complicated kinds of issues. And this is exactly what the poskim have grappled with for a long time. So one of the earliest sources to deal with this is known as the Zecher Yitzchak, and one of his first responsa, it's actually the second one in his entire collection, he addresses this question that he had that had been posed to him. So he writes as follows. He says, in his opinion, it's very difficult. And this becomes the majority view, is that if we know that the child will not grow up observing Torah mitzvot, that we could not call that a merit and or the acceptance of mitzvot, and we would, again, not be able to accept this conversion. He says, but here, where the father and mother are sinners for the entire Torah and do not genuinely desire to introduce him into the category of the commandments, since they themselves do not observe, it's unlike a case in which his father brought him for conversion, because conversion is the acceptance of the entire Torah. If so, it is only as if we brought him and we lack the power, in other words, the power to accept Torah mitzvot on behalf of this child. Moreover, since we know that he will not observe the commandments, he will certainly violate all the prohibitions in the Torah when he grows up in such a home. If so, this is not a merit for him, but a demerit. And in such a case, we do not say that we perform a merit for a person. So the Zecher Yitzchak Paskins, it is a greater zechut to be a Gentile, and it holds for Stuart, right? That it's better to be the Gentile than to be the sinning Jew. This is the view of Rav Kook as well. Rav Kook, we're not going to read the whole thing inside, but Rav Kook in his response to Dan Kohen, where he deals with many questions of conversions, we saw last time that Rav Kook took a strong line in terms of the requirement to go out and vote for adults, and he does the same for children as well. He says in the second paragraph, but if where it is clear that their intention is in no way to observe and refrain from the Torah's commandments, of what use is it that they transmit him to the court for conversion by the court's consent? There's no Kabbalah mitzvot, there's nothing to talk about, if it's obvious. For if it is obvious that their transmission is no better than had he transmitted himself to conversion with circumcision and immersion, for since the acceptance of commandments is lacking, it's not a conversion at all. And it is indeed the case... sorry, that shouldn't say a prayer, it should be a fortiori. In other words, what he's saying is, if it's true that an adult who comes to us is not willing to accept mitzvah, then all the more so for the child, where there's even less of a guarantee. We're talking about they don't even have their own intention to bring to bear. This entire category of conversion is not obvious. It's not intuitive. So this is all the more so that such a conversion is not going to work. This explains a line in the letter at the beginning.
Is that an argument against converting children?
It's an argument against converting children if it's clear cut that the parents will not be observant. Now, the devil, again, so what kind of commitment they have to have? If you go back to the letter in source 2, you'll now appreciate something there. He says, the rabbis, right, these are the rabbis who come from the Rav Kook world. First page, source 2, fourth paragraph, toward the bottom of page 1. He says, and above all, the mass conversion of minors goes against the halakhic opinions of the vast majority of Torah sages in recent generations. So that includes the Zecher Yitzchak that we saw. First and foremost, Rabbi Kook. First and foremost, Rabbi Kook. How did they know? That was the response that we just read. So they invoke their own Rabbi Rav Kook. What are you saying? You're going to go do this, but it's against our own master. If the Russian Olim clearly are not going to observe the mitzvot, then maybe we should try to find a solution, but this is not it. And that's their argument. Rav Moshe Feinstein on American Shores dealt with this issue. That appears in Source 9. He has a little bit of a more mixed kind of response. Rav Moshe seems to say that he does not ideally support such a conversion. He doesn't think it's the right thing, but he's not 100% sure that it's definitely not effectual. And he says like this. He says, however, it's proper Zirudeya in Chilak Aleph Simon Kuf Nun Ches 1158. However, it's proper that when he grows up, we should immerse him again for conversion before the court. For it's not clear in this country that it's a merit. Right? In other words, you're growing in America, there's no guarantee you're going to stay observant. It's a very mixed community. So therefore, he says, don't assume that definitely it's going to work. For a great saint, it's likely that he will, God forbid, not observe Shabbat and similar prohibitions. However, it is plausible that it is nonetheless a merit. For it's better to be a sinning Gentile. I mistranslated. It was my translation, my mistake. It's better to be a sinning Jew, than a Gentile. That's a very strong... I'll go back online and change it. That's a big difference. Go back and correct it afterward. But, that's a major theological statement. Rav Moshe says it's better to be a sinning Jew than to be a Gentile, and therefore maybe we should accept the conversion. Note, this is very interesting. What that would mean is in order to conceptually accept the Russian Olim, you'd have to theologically be making the argument that it is better to be a sinning Jew than to be a Gentile. That's the underlying assumption, apparently, of those who would wish to convert the children. That's complicated. All right, it's just it's interesting to think about the whole thing. Okay.
You have to get the philosophers here to discuss that.
What?
That would be an interesting question for philosophers.
Well, it goes to, again, a couple of core questions. Jews and Gentiles are two streams of thought. There's a sort of an inherent camp that sees a fundamental difference, and then there's the Rambam and Rav Hirsch and many other Soloveitchik who felt that there's no essential distinction. It's just that Jews have an overlay of Kedushat Yisrael with certain, again, rights, but more responsibilities. That's how Rav Soloveitchik saw it. So this doesn't seem to fit philosophically in that camp. This would be, and Rav Kook himself was more of an essentialist. The mystical tradition were more essentialists. So the Zohar sees a basic, more basic difference. The Maharal of Prague, leading to Rav Kook, those who are more influenced by mysticism see a more basic distinction between Jew and Gentile, the Kuzari and the like. So. Okay, we're running into the clock, so I just want to wrap up momentarily. If you take a look at source 10, Rabbi Jachter, who's a rabbi in Teaneck, mentioned that Rav Soloveitchik quotes two students of Rabbi Soloveitchik, including Rabbi Lookstein. So Rabbi Adler is the principal at TABC, Rosh Hashiva. Rav Soloveitchik had a sort of a compromise view. He considers zechud if the non-observant parents commit to providing the child with a yeshiva education. And there's a similar position of an Israeli or Yisrael Rosen, who has a similar compromise, although he says if the parents are not Jewish, or even one parent is not Jewish, he already said he feels very strong to accept that case. That happens. It's not uncommon to have a case of two parents, one Jewish, one non-Jewish, who want to convert the child. And that becomes a really challenging situation. I suspect that typically the RCA would not convert such a child, but I don't know for sure. But these are the kinds of really challenging situations. I gave you the guidelines of the RCA. The RCA has their Soloveitchik's compromise, basically. And they say like this. They say, if there's going to be no acceptance of an insult whatsoever, we cannot accept such a child. But we can be more lenient than we could for a typical conversion. So they say, the ideal is that they have to belong to an Orthodox synagogue within walking distance of their home, commit to 12 years of Orthodox day school education from that child, and so on and so forth. Right? And then he says, ideally, said there should be full elements, full observant elements such as Shabbat, Kashrut, holidays, etc. And then they'd say, however, and this is a common compromise among the poskim, where this cannot be accomplished, and at the very minimum, there need to be the following. Significant observance of Shabbat, go define significant, right? But that's the right, complete observance of Kashrut, which is interesting. This is one, there are many other variations of this idea that you find around. This is just one. A positive, I don't mean of the RCA, I mean there, other poskim have similar different variations on this theme. Positive attitude toward full mitzvah observance and commitment to halacha within the basic family unit. After consultation with the Rabbinical Council of America/Beit Din of America, and after writing an explanatory memo, and so on and so forth, Gior Katan conversion of the child may be allowed. They're trying, this is not an unusual compromise, to say no acceptance of mitzvah whatsoever, that we're not going to do, but there can be a little bit more flexibility in this case than there could be in other situations. I gave you the Achiezer, who was a great posik of the 20th century, who also has a sort of this kind of compromise kind of view, and that serves as a basis for some of these psakim. And Rav Ovadia also has a similar kind of psaki, would appear. Gave to you at the end here, where after reviewing the literature, he says there must be some sort of acceptance of mitzvot, but maybe there can be, again, greater flexibility than there could be in other scenarios. The rabbis who believe that we should nonetheless convert the children in Israel must be willing to go a step beyond this. And so what they're saying is as follows. They're saying, under normal circumstances, as students of Rav Kook, in general, as halachists, we would not do this. But what we are saying is, what we say, she'atad chak k'di'eved dami. In other words, a difficult scenario in which there's an emergency situation requires us to take brave and urgent action that we otherwise might not have taken. True, the Rabbinical Council of America, if we were running the RCA in America, we might also have conversion standards that are like this. There isn't a Russian Olim crisis. It's not a question of the demographics of the future state of Israel, and so on and so forth. So they don't deny this, but what they're saying is that given the situation, we can rely on a few things. Remember, Maimonides, the Rambam last time we saw in Shulchan Aruch, according to one plausible reading, maybe didn't require the acceptance of mitzvah altogether. You want to tell me you don't accept an adult? Fair enough. But when it comes to children, there's added argument for leniency, because after all, the whole notion of the acceptance of mitzvot is questionable. And there is reason to think that maybe you don't require acceptance of mitzvot for the child because it's meaningless there, and what you really require is that the fundamental commitment to raise them Jewishly or something more generic like that, and that it can maybe, following Rav Moshe, etc., it can be considered as a chut just to be a Jew, even if I'm going to become a sinning Jew. We wouldn't have done this, but we feel that we have no choice. Others say that, yes, there's an emergency, but this idea of conversion, and this fundamental principle of the acceptance of mitzvot, is so essential that we don't believe this is the right solution. What then would be the right solution? I don't know if there is another solution. Maybe Elie Fischer is right. Maybe the solution is that to allow it to resolve itself. I don't know. But that just to frame, those are at least the core issues that we have here.
Yeah, a question. You haven't addressed the issue of Zera Yisrael. So if you have, for instance, a non-Jewish mother and a Jewish father, so are the standards for conversion, is there more latitude?
Great question. Yeah, so one of the arguments Rabbi Riska mentioned this when he came... is that in some of these cases it's even easier because there's this idea of Zera Yisrael, that if the father is Jewish, that does not make the child Jewish per se, but that makes the standards lower. There's some halachic evidence for this. My sense is that among poskim, that's very much an idea that's rooted in the Sephardic poskim, and the Ashkenazic poskim are much less attracted to that. This Beit Din, I don't think they would use it in typical circumstances, but they do rely on that given the exigency. So it's an added argument that they use for leniency, but they don't exclusively rely on that. In other words, they would be willing to convert a child even outside the framework of Zera Yisrael, but it becomes an added element of the argument where it's pertinent, makes it even easier to go ahead with the conversion. So that's part of the conversation. Obviously, these questions are a difficult one, not only on the demographic side, but in terms of thinking holistically and in a unified fashion as a Jewish community. Obviously, we're not there yet, and obviously there are significant challenges that these questions raise for us. But I think at least in our own lives, I think just the sensitivity and the awareness of the complexity of the experience of what it means to be a convert or to be a prospective convert in our community, I think increases our awareness. And I think at minimum, if we're not going to be the ones to decide these matters for the Jewish community in our own personal interactions, I think there's a tremendous opportunity for Kiddush Hashem. There are so many wonderful people out there who have made heroic decisions or considering making heroic decisions for themselves and their families, and hopefully we'll come together as a community to really be supportive and even more sensitive of the significant challenges, and in that way to do our part to build a truly embracing and loving community for all of our members.
So. Amen.
At least at the end with something positive. You know, you have the Haftarah, something positive
very nice
here as well.